Accession number 18481, Reel 3.
Len Bradfield, Reel 3.
Well, we had these temporary huts, which were about 5 feet high by about 14 feet long by about 12 feet wide, which accommodated, I should think, somewhere in the region of about 20 people. It was absolutely like sardines in a tin. And they were locked in those from dusk to dawn. Then latterly, they got the actual huts up, proper huts up, which would meet the requirements of the protecting power. And they had no fireplaces, so they called for volunteers to work with the Germans building chimneys. So I built some chimneys with the, well, I laboured for the German building chimneys. And he was quite a friendly old character. And I realised then that the Germans appreciated that they were losing the war.
How did you come to that conclusion?
Uli said, in the way of his attitude, that things were not going well in the East and they were not going well in the West. And in fact, I'd never heard a German that had been so despondent. That's just immaterial. To carry on with the Haida, to carry on it to Grosse Tichel, we remained there until the January of 45, when the Germans were approaching quite rapidly from the east, heading for the Elbe. And we were then marched out, and with no real target place to go. We were marching for days up towards Kolberg and along the north coast, and at which time we were very short of food, and there was no accommodation sort of worked out wherever we went. It was a case of having to ad hoc into a barn or whatever and hope for the best. You could see the Germans were in a bit of a muddle, and we then came to the conclusion that the Russians were advancing so fast and the Allies in the east, in the west, were having so much trouble with the Ardennes offensive that possibly the thing to do was to leave the column and try and let the war pass over us and the Russians recaptured by the Russians. So a colleague and I decided that we would leave the column and hide up when we were in one of these barn situations. We'd been marching wandering about several weeks then. We hid up in this Swede camp and waited for the Russians to come. Well, they didn't. And I woke up one morning, we'd been there 3 days, and Nicky's hands were all swollen, obviously frostbitten, and his ears were swollen, obviously frostbitten. So I said, I bet your feet are frozen as well. So he sort of had a look, and yes, he had. And I said, well, I'll have to leave you, and I'll go out and take off. You come out and surrender later. So I got up and fell flat on my face because my feet had gone. So I said, I crawled out and hailed some Germans. And fortunately, I didn't get shot. I expected to be shot because we'd been told if we were wandering about, we would be shot out of hand. But I explained that I got frostbite, and I also got a colleague with frostbite. And they recaptured us and took us off and sent us off to a Kriegsgefangene Lazarette at Neue Brandenburg, where I had my front halves and my feet amputated to get rid of the frostbite.
Did they do that properly?
Yes, that was done by Polish surgeons. The surgeon kept in the Polish Navy, the only one they had. He'd been captured in 1939.
Were you with your colleague?
Yes, he had operated on him as well, but he had to be reamped and he died. The majority of people there were amputations, basically through frostbite or trench foot. And a lot of it had got to amoebic dysentery, which was a very bad setup because they were dying quite rapidly. And also in the Russian compound, they thought they'd got typhus. But I don't think they could have done because it would have gone through the whole lot of us. But at this stage, the Russians turned up. And they had a battle over the town of Neue Brandenburg. And they captured the camp. And 3 weeks later, they handed us back to the Americans. After much argy-bargy, they didn't want to let us go to the Americans. And the Americans begin to realise that the Russian allies weren't all that wonderful because they couldn't understand why we wanted to go back to be handed back for the simple reason. They said, why do you want to go back to your own people? You're only going to get court-martialed when you get back, which was what happened to the Russians. So after much argy-bargy, they decided to let us go back and they let us take the Polish surgeon and his entourage with us because they said we needed them. But it was a wonderful way of getting them back to the West because they would otherwise have been gathered into Eastern Germany.
What impression did the appearance of the Russians and their behaviour make on you?
The fact that the young officer that came in could speak very good French. He got passable English, quite good German. He explained that they were not going to stop at the Elbe; they were going to the Atlantic. And we took that on board then that was it. The Russians were under the impression that they were going to be given Europe.
Had they expected any resistance from
the Americans? No, they thought the Americans would be only too pleased. They'd just go home. And the English would go back to their island.
Did you try to argue with him?
Well, I said that wasn't the way we saw it. But as they were now in the detaining power situation, you weren't going to argue unduly with them. Very nice people, really.
What did the Russian army look like?
What we got was a mixed regiment, which was Siberian Rifles. They were Muscovite officers and Asiatic troops, all armed with a little submachine gun, you know, the little round drum job. They all rode on the tanks. They weren't very communicative at all. I don't think they spoke Russian even. They spoke amongst themselves, but they wouldn't attempt to speak to us. As we were all in bed, all with gangrene, all smelling pretty horrible, I can quite see why. They had one woman soldier who was a sniper and nurse. She got her sniper rifle, she got marks on, and she also came round and did the sort of bed bath sort of situation, and also did blood transfusions with a syringe where they pumped the blood from the bottle and then switched it over and then pumped it into the vein and then backwards and forwards rocking the actual suction blotion situation so you didn't get air bubbles. it put you into a very high sweat, because, I mean, with that rate of blood transfusion, apparently it should prove fatal, but it didn't. But, after the 3 weeks, we were put up in trucks and taken out to onto Lüneburg Heath, and then flown back to Britain.
So from Neubrandenburg to Lüneburg?
Yeah, by truck, by ambulance.
So what medical condition were you in Britain by the time you got back?
I was weighing 8 stone. I got to quite severe gangrene. They put me on penicillin, and in, 24 hours, the flow of pus had stopped. I stopped smelling. And this was when you were being injected with penicillin, straight into the buttock. And the results were absolutely miraculous.
How did the RAF treat you in England?
Oh, well, I went up to RAF Cosford, which was the principal RAF hospital for returning POWs, and they were very good there. As soon as I was dried up and reasonably, I decided I didn't want to be re-amped, because they wanted to re-amputate me below knee, because I would fit the conventional appliance rather than work on the basis of leaving me with these 2 stunts, because they said I would not get, wouldn't do more than about 15 years before I'd have to be re-amped. Well, I'm now 76 and I'm still carrying on with the same amputation.
The original one that the pole?
Yeah.
Were you satisfied with your treatment as a returning POW in England?
Well, I mean, I went on leave. I brought back to Croydon, was on leave there. 1 foot blew up, reinfected. Basically, they reckon there must have been a little bit of bone left in somewhere. And they took me to Croydon sick bay of the airport. And the MO there said no way was he going to have me die on his hands. So he pushed me off to the EMS hospital at Epsom, which is a King's College, at Horton. And it was only 6 RAF in the place. The rest of it were all Army and was 1 or 2 Navy. And there I met my wife, who was my physiotherapist there. And I was there for several weeks, and then sent home on indefinite leave, pending convalescence and coming out of the service. Obviously, I was no use to the service, so I ended up with no longer fulfilling the physical requirements. But that went on until September 46, I was fiddling about. So that was quite satisfactory, because I got myself fixed up to go back to the school of building, where I converted to be a quant disciplinary.
Now, just if we can go back to your POW camps, as I understand it, you were in Bart to start off with.
That's on the north coast.
Near Stettin.
Yeah.
And then you went to Heidekrug.
Yes, which is right over in it was east of East Prussia, if you get what I mean.
The Memel area.
Yeah. Memel was about the place we came out with on the old steamship, the Instabird. But this is also where the commandant and his wife used to go round the perimeter of the compound every Sunday with his wife and 2 daughters and their dachshunds. And they were all very prim and proper. And this was very much, he was a very formal officer. And one of his favourite remarks was, if we were being rowdy or anything on parade, "We did not behave like this at Donington Park." Apparently he had been a prisoner of war in the First War. But the real beauty of the parade round the compound was that We had some Australians there that used to dig little shallow pits where they used to lay and sunbathe as nature intended. They then got an order out that we should stand and give eyes right or left to all German officers to show respect. Of course, the Americans used to salute without a cap. We would not salute without caps. But these Australians had obviously got this well thought out because they were waiting on Sunday for the commandant and his wife and the daughters to come round. And then they let out a yell of, "Attention, ice front!" and stood up there as nature intended. With the German Frau being absolutely horrified, hiding her daughter's eyes, and it was absolute pandemonium. And then, of course, the instruction was rescinded. But he was a very good commandant there.
What was so good about him?
Well, he was correct, you know. He didn't let anything happen that shouldn't happen. Unlike Picard at Tichau, who was an absolute villain. He was the one that had the people run up the road. He also used to have machine gun practice across the compound without warning. And his life ambition was to manage to catch anybody over the warning wire. We did have one man shot.
Why had he adopted this attitude, do you think?
I think he'd had rather severe problems from having family killed with air raids. He was definitely paranoid about bomber crews.
What number POW camp was Heidekrug?
Heidekrug was Luft 6. We were Lager K Luft 6. And then Grosse Tichau was Luft 4.
And how did Barth compare with these other two
camps? Well, Barth was the original camp. That was POW camp, Stammlag der Luftwaffe 1, number 1. And that was mixed originally. Then it became, when we were moved out to Heidekrug, it became an officer's camp. Latterly, it became an American officer's camp. But that was a very good camp. It was alongside of a flak school. Another little story there. While we were at Barth, Italy had just gone out of the war. And they had got a whole lot of Italians who were training at the flak school. And one morning they came and marched the Italians into our compound and said, "These are your allies. These were Italians that had not followed the Duce and accepted Bagdaglio's armistice." So we had them in there for about a week till they moved them into another camp.
What were they like?
Well, we never had any contact with them. They were in the football ground, and football ground with some tents, and we were in our two compounds. But I did think it was rather funny that they should think that we would suddenly welcome their allies as our allies when they changed sides in the middle. Ridiculous state of affairs.
How, in general, do you feel now about the way in which you were treated by the Germans as a POW?
Apart from the run up the road, I think it was more or less correct, as near as they could. We were very short of food. If it hadn't been for the Red Cross, we wouldn't have survived.
And how do you feel now about having served in Bomber Command in the war?
Oh, I think we did the right thing. The whole point is that at the time we had no alternative. I mean, that was the only weapon we'd got. I admitted that it was a very costly weapon because, I mean, for the amount of damage we did, the casualties we took were absolutely horrendous. Whether you could have won the war by bombing is doubtful, because it was never allowed to be tried right out.
What do you think about the criticisms which are currently being made about bomber commands?
Well, I'm very cross about them. I mean, I always reckon that the Bishop of St Albans, as it was, who was the first one in conjunction with Stafford Cripps, had been court-martialed. I mean, giving aid and succour to the enemy, if anybody ever was.
Was it the Bishop of St Albans or Bishop of Chichester?
Bishop of Chichester, that's right. Sorry, wrong bloke.
And your feelings about having served in the Second World War generally?
I think it was necessary. I can't see, I can't see any other solution.
Are you proud of having served in the RAF?
Yes.
Do you belong to the RAF Association?
Yes, and Bomber Command Association.
And I think the POWs Association.
Yeah.
Do you have a squadron association?
Yes, we're having a reunion at Peterborough this 28th of this month.